This evening I'd like to continue with my series of talks on the seven factors of awakening. And as a little bit of a background for these seven factors, movement of freedom, the movement of deep liberating insight, in its most deep transformative way, takes just a moment. It doesn't take long. And to really be able to see through the illusion that we cling to often, the delusions we live our life by, the things that we grasp and cling to that can cause a tremendous amount of suffering. And in the moment, it's possible to experience the freedom of just letting go, kind of opening up the hands of the mind and just being free and open, receptive, available, empty of self-clinging, empty of, you know, greed, hate, and delusion, they say. So as they say, you know, it can take just a moment. However, to get to that moment can take a while. And and for different people, it's different length of time. It's like if you want to go to, suppose if you want to go visit the Pacific, and you go over the, you know, come around the bend or over the crest or go down San Gregorio Road, and you suddenly see the Pacific, you see it suddenly. You don't see it gradually. You might see a sliver first, but it's a sudden sliver. And depending how long you have to drive, you know, if you live in Redwood City, it takes 45 minutes to go over the hill. If you live in, you know, in Fremont, it takes longer. If you live in Las Vegas, it takes longer. And the further east you go, it takes longer to get to the. It takes a while. So we don't know where we're at. But the analogy for the path of the progress of development of practice is sometimes it's a path, it's a road. But I like the analogy or the metaphor of a farmer planting a seed, which the Buddha gave that story, that metaphor. The farmer plants the seed and keeps the seed watered and fertilized and things, and the plant will grow and eventually it bears fruit. And you can't really hurry it along. You know, you can't go along and, you know, a little seedling and pull out the roots and see how it's going. You know, that just, you know, then you don't have a, it's going to die. So you have to kind of leave it alone, and you have to trust the natural process of this inner growth. And in that regard, Buddhism, these teachings of the Buddha, focuses on the kind of inner growth that's kind of organic or natural, like a plant, but also like a human being, like a child that's growing. There's to understand that the growth of a child, we understand developmental psychology. The child develops in various ways over time. And in Buddhist spiritual life, that development continues. In fact, all organic things evolve in a variety of ways. And we can allow ourselves to be the victim, or the, I don't know if victim is the right word, but can we allow ourselves to be the recipient of just the natural growth and development as it, you know, as it might come to us, or we can participate in it, and just like the farmer participates in watering and fertilizing the plant. You can participate in the process. So some people grow as children, perhaps, until they're 18 or 21 or something, some magic day, and then they stop growing. And some people kind of stagnate, just kind of reach a plateau in their life, and there's not much further development that goes on. The major big movements happen, you know, finished by the time they come out of teenagehood. And but it's also possible to have tremendous amount of growth going on into adulthood, into old age. Some people have a big gap from, you know, the time they turn 20, they stop growing until they turn about 75. And then there's a rapid growth again. And I think spiritual practice of any kind, hopefully, is a way of continuing a natural process of development. It's not like adding something strange, but it's taking where we're at as adults, perhaps, and letting that continue and fostering a continuation of what I would like to believe is just a natural process of growth and development. So in this process of growth and development, in the Buddha talks about the seven factors of awakening. And these can be understood as seven different factors of mind or heart, psychological factors, that get activated when a person does meditation practice in a consistent, deep way. And as these inner qualities, they're all qualities we all have. So they're qualities of mindfulness, paying attention, qualities of investigation, quality of energy, quality of joy. And joy is a topic for tonight. And then tranquility, or peace, serenity, a quality of concentration, and the quality of equanimity. That's seven. So these are all capacities we all have. They're potentials we all have. There's the mechanism inside our minds, inside our brain or body, for those things to be there, to be evoked and be strong. For many of us, it can be dormant capacities. But with practice, those capacities can be evoked, can be activated, can be watered and developed. And in particular, the seven factors of awakening are very important factors for meditation practice. And in their own time, they become stronger, develop. And when meditation practice is at its strongest, and particularly on retreats, then these seven factors can become so strong that they become the primary experiences, primary thing a person, people are aware of. So you know, you're not really aware anymore necessarily of people around you, the room, your history, what's happened to you yesterday, what you had for breakfast, what's happening tomorrow, that you have to worry about your taxes or something. You know, a lot of things fall away. And remarkably, what you're really engaged in is something that's very much in the present moment. And remarkably, in very deep meditation, it can be these seven factors become your primary experience. So it's quite something, you know, the experience of strong mindfulness, strong powers of investigation, strong sense of energy or engagement, strong joy, strong tranquility, strong concentration, and very strong equanimity. Now, in its developmental model of Buddhism, the things develop over time, the seven factors of awakening are also presented in a developmental approach, where mindfulness is first, and we start paying attention. And with the paying attention, with enough attention, as we pay attention to what's going on here, we get kind of interested. What is there going on here? Not just paying attention to what's here, not just being present, but we get interested. What is this really? What's this life about? What's our experience like? What's it like being a human being? And that sense of maybe curiosity or interest or investigations, process of wanting to discover much more deeply, perhaps even a kind of love of discovery. What is this? What's going on here? And that's that becomes the foundation for energy. Because if you really want to discover, if you get interested, you'll apply energy. If you're not interested, you're not going to apply the energy. And then with the energy comes joy, which is we'll talk about more today. When you're energetically engaged and involved, it tends to bring up joy. With that strong joy and engagement, then there's a way that morphs into tranquility. And joy and tranquility together are wonderful conditions, or the ground for strong concentration. And then strong concentration is the ground for, or the seed or the water for equanimity to sprout. And equanimity sometimes is considered to be one of the crown jewels or one of the greatest fruits that the plant can produce. So there's kind of a developmental approach where they kind of build on each other. One leads to the other. And here at IMC, we focus a lot on mindfulness practice. That's kind of the entryway to all this, the beginning, the entry. And then with that entry, then the others, with time, as you do this practice thoroughly and consistently, especially, as I said, on retreat, where you can just devote yourself to it all the time, these other factors grow. So today's factor is joy. And people don't always associate joy with Buddhism. And some people think that we Buddhists are kind of, especially if you come by IMC, and a day we do this half-day one-day sittings, on Saturday, and people are doing walking meditation out on the sidewalk here. And, you know, you wouldn't, I'm sure people in Redwood City don't think they were joyful. They have these zombies out there, you know, these strange people at IMC who walk around really slow, Night of the Living Dead, you know, walking around. Or we keep talking about suffering. Suffering. Those Buddhists, they're always talking about suffering. Give me a break. You know, we should do some, you know, positive thinking. Affirmations, that would be good. But the suffering thing just wears me down. So sometimes people don't associate Buddhism with joy. But in fact, I hope that joy is a strong hallmark of Buddhist practice overall, even though we can't expect joy all the time. And sometimes, in fact, Buddhist practice does take us into the dark night of the soul, takes us into the fire, takes us into the recesses and monsters of our psyche. And that's an important part of the process sometimes. But overall, over a period of time, hopefully there's joy as part of it. And certainly in the early Buddhist tradition, the records that survive, that's written by the Buddhists themselves, so maybe a little bit biased, they write that the Buddhist community of the time, the earliest Buddhist community, was recognized for its joy and its lightness and smiles and friendliness. And it was a little bit surprised to people who were, there was a very strong ascetic tradition in ancient India. And people kind of expected the renunciants, these people and serious spiritual practitioners, to be renunciants. And they were kind of surprised when they kind of came to the Buddhist monks and found them kind of, you know, just light and happy and smiling. What's going on? A lot of people will, you know, put a lot of emphasis on the Buddha's awakening, on awakening. The name for the Buddha comes from the word awake, a bodhi. And the one who is awake. And the seven factors of awakening has the word bodhi in it as well. So the focus sometimes is on the awakening. But there's another earlier point in the Buddha's practice which is very important, which was the Buddha's entry, or the door that he took to follow his path to awakening. So he searched, he was casting about, searching around for some way to become free or liberated. And he wasn't finding anything. And then he found the key. And the key that he discovered was joy. Isn't that interesting? So the joy was the way in. And what happened was that, as the story is told, he was about 35 or 36 years old. He'd been practicing some 6 years, 7 years, ascetic practices, different meditation practices of the time. And then he was about to, he tried it all, and none of it seemed to go where he wanted to go. And then he remembered a time when he was 6 years old. And he was a spring day, I assume in nice weather. And he was left outdoors on the edge of a field where his father was doing the ceremonial plowing, first plowing of the year. And he was kind of forgotten in the ceremony of the first plowing. And he was sitting in the shade of a rose apple tree. And sitting there, maybe in a way that sometimes children can experience, he sat upright and experienced, entered into a kind of state of concentration where there was joy that arose. And sometimes children can have this kind of spontaneous, seemingly spontaneous experiences of delight or joy or concentration that are quite meaningful. And sometimes as adults, sometimes they're forgotten. And I think a few people, when they start meditating, remember, rather than remembering dark memories, difficult memories, they remember the joyful ones that arise. So I'll give you one example in my own life. When I was about 10 or so, I took this public bus to school in Trieste, in a city in Italy where I lived. And I lived kind of the end of the bus line. So in the afternoon, I'd come home from school and buy my ticket and everything. And the way they had the buses back then, they had the driver and they had the conductor who sold the tickets. And so, you know, so what I discovered was I should always sit in the same seat on the bus, because it was like maybe 4 seats back from the front. Because as we got near the end of the bus line, and the conductor was not going to sell any more tickets, he would come and take a seat near the front of the bus. And he had this ledger, and he would write down a record of how many one-way, how many doubles, how many children, how many old people, whatever, you know, different tickets that he would sell. And he had this ledger, wrote it down. And if I sat just the right place, I could look over his shoulder and watch him do his ledgering, his recording. And all I knew as a 10-year-old was I would feel really good. I would just feel kind of whole, like everything became whole, complete. My body kind of started feeling really warm and full and light. And everything kind of fell away from, you know, from my any concern or thoughts or worries or anything. And I just felt kind of just everything was good. And I think when I look back at that experience as an adult, it became a reference point for me for meditation practice. It became a reference point of what's possible that I'd forgotten about. And also it became, I understood it as very simply that I was getting concentrated. I was getting absorbed. There was some way in which I was kind of completely absorbed in that, kind of pulled in to his keeping his record with his pen, that everything else dropped away. Now, why I got so absorbed, I can't tell you. But, you know, and then when I was in college, I remember I loved to take, I wouldn't say love exactly, but I kind of looked forward to taking certain exams, especially exams where you had to write little essays. And like I took these history classes, and I'd fill my mind with all these historical facts that would only stay in there for, you know, as long as I needed for the exam, and then it was gone. But it was there long enough for the exam. And then I would take an exam. There's so much concentration in the exam. You're kind of involved. Everything else falls away. And in that complete absorption in taking exams, I would feel so good. Especially when I left. I mean, not in relief, but I was not in relief of the exam being done, but feeling completely emptied, purified in that process. And I would leave these classrooms and look around and just felt so cleansed, and everything was so beautiful and sparkly and so full. So this idea of getting concentrated and then having joy, some kind of joy or some kind of well-being arise, is something that even a six-year-old child can have, or some different people can have at times. It can happen. And the Buddha remembered that he had that experience as a child. And how he analyzed that was, he said that kind of joy was a non-sensual joy. And this was very important, because in that ancient Indian tradition, where asceticism was very important, sensual joy was mistrust. Getting a massage, or, you know, all the kind of sensual joys we can have, was mistrusted. And so the idea was to not engage in that, because that was unreliable and not a source of ultimate happiness. But he found this particular joy or happiness that came out of this concentrated state, that wasn't born from sensuality. It was born from it's called non-sensual joy. It's a technical word in Buddhism. And so it arose from that state of concentration. And the Buddha said, he thought to himself, because it's not sensual, it's not blameworthy, or it's not unreliable. And so he decided that that was the door. And so he entered into that joy, he entered that state of concentration, and used that absorption with that joy as a way of getting his mind still enough, quiet enough, and insightful enough, penetrating enough, to see deeply into the very roots of his psyche. So here we see, in some ways, the beginning of Buddhism, can be said, was the door into Buddhism for the Buddha was through this experience of joy. So that's one place where you see joy as being important. You see joy, the emphasis in joy and well-being appearing in many different places in the Buddha's teaching. A number of different lists has joy as an important part of it. Joy, delight, happiness are all important terms. Sometimes in English these terms are translated as rapture or bliss. I prefer be a little more low-key about it. So joy and happiness and well-being I like. Delight, gladness is used sometimes. And what's interesting is that some people associate meditation, Buddhist meditation, with concentration. And some people, when they sit down to meditate, feel like, I have to get concentrated. And they bear down. That's what the whole name of the game is, concentration. I gotta get concentrated. It has to be now, you know, or before my neighbor at least. Or, you know, because we have such a strong association with some people with concentration. It turns out that one of the ways to get concentrated, a healthy way to get concentrated, the healthy kind of concentration we're talking about in Buddhism, arises out of joy, out of a sense of well-being and happiness. That if you don't have some modicum of well-being, of happiness, then it's difficult to get a strong, healthy concentration going. So some people bypass, forget about the joy part, and just try to, you know, okay, let's just get this concentration thing going. So it's certainly easier to talk about having joy than doing it, and I can well imagine that some of you now feel oppressed or discouraged. Because, you know, gee, you know, I don't have much joy, and now I'm being told joy is important, and I guess I came into the wrong place. And maybe I should have, that old school Buddhism was better for me, the kind that talked about suffering. Because there, I saw myself, but I don't see myself today, it's a joy thing. So, but again, remember it's a developmental process, so that joy itself is conditioned in other things being in place. And so it's a matter of kind of finding the right nutriments that can nourish the arising of well-being and happiness. So one of them, for example, is living ethically, having personal integrity. This is one of the nourishments for joy. If you expect to have joy and you're going around lying, stealing, and killing, you know, something is not right, you know. So you got to clean up your act. Another source of joy is a certain kind of healthy faith or confidence. Confidence in the practice, confidence in the goal, confidence in yourself. And so confidence itself can bring a kind of certain level of well-being. So if you don't have confidence, then maybe that's what needs to be addressed, is to look at confidence. In this list of the seven factors of awakening, energy is a precursor for joy. And how I understand that is that as you practice your mindfulness, as you practice mindfulness and really be present for this experience of your life, and you hear enough to notice what's happening, you get interested. You get looking more deeply. You investigate. As you investigate, there's energy that arises. Energy of engagement, of questioning, of wondering, what is this experience? What's going on? And as we have energy and as we investigate, one of the things we start discovering is all the ways in which we are fragmented, all the ways in which our mind goes off in all kinds of different directions. And we notice how easy it is the mind to go into the future, the past, into fantasy, into thoughts of other, you know, things. And we get caught up in all these different worlds of thoughts and thinking. And it disperses our energy, it disperses our mind, our attention. And so you start noticing that. And at some point, as you engage more fully in your present moment experience, two things can happen. One is you start naturally, or you start choicefully, letting go of all the distracting movements of the mind. You start stop being interested in thinking about your planning list you're making for tomorrow. You let go of your resentments from yesterday or from 10 years ago, because you realize that that's not the present moment. That keeps you scattered, it keeps you distracted, it keeps you removed from a deep entering into this present moment. So you let go of these things. The second is that even if you don't let go of them intentionally, they fall away as you get more and more engaged and interested in this present moment experience. So even if something as simple as your breathing, if you get really interested in your breathing and really committed to your breathing, say, I'm going to be more committed to my breathing than I am to all of my resentments. I'm going to be more committed to my breathing than to all the fantasies I have about what's going to happen in the future for me. I'm more committed to my breathing than all my... what else? All my self-preoccupation. I'm going to be more committed to my breathing than all the ways in which I am critical of myself or critical of others. I'm more committed to my breathing than I am trying to figure out how far I've gone in my concentration, in a measure of how far I've gotten. So the idea is to be completely committed. If you're really committed to your breathing in a strong way, then naturally the preoccupation and other things will fall away. And when we get really involved and have that kind of, in Buddhism we talk about a unification process happens. We get unified where our intentions, our bodily sensations, our emotions, our thoughts, all are working in the same direction for the same purpose. So if you're following your breath, for example, focusing on your breath, your intention is to be with your breath. Your body sensations are not only the sensations of your body breathing, but also as you get concentrated, there's sensations of energy, sensations of lightness, of warmth, of vibration, of different things that begin happening in your body that are a result of getting concentrated, that all kind of come along with, holistically or wholly come along around or with the focus on the breath. So there's bodily sensations. There are your emotions or feelings. Joy arises, sense of well-being arises in connection to it. And then your thoughts, if you're thinking at all, then your thinking is also, you're thinking about the breath. You're engaged in the mental, your cognitive life is focused on the breath experience itself and what's happening for you here and now. Now, it could, from a distance, seem very boring to have your life organized around your whole body, your being, organized around something as simple as the breath. But it tends to create a lot of strong sense of well-being or pleasure to have your whole body harmonized, working for the same purpose at the same time, concentrating the same way. And it tends to, and everything else falls away. The forces of distraction, the forces of irritation, the forces of worry, the forces of preoccupation fall away. Then it gets replaced by a sense of well-being. Happiness, joy, delight. Just a delight to have everything who you are working harmoniously together in the same direction for the same thing. It's easier said than done, of course, but that's the direction in which the practice can go. And so it takes a lot of mindfulness to see what's going on well. It takes a strong commitment to notice what's happening and stay with the noticing as opposed to getting carried away into the thoughts and concerns we have. And then it takes a real interest to discover what's really going on here in the mind. How does the mind work? Am I pushing too hard? Am I too complacent? You know, what's happening in the mind? The investigation, the qualities of the mind as you're doing it. And as you get familiar with your mind, get familiar with yourself, we tend to find the right balance of energy. Not pushing too hard, not pushing too little. But we feel ourselves engaged. And when this joy, some people will call joy zest. Or another word they have is rapt attention. Rapt being closely connected to rapture. So your attention, your interest, your energy is all connected and engaged in an energetic way, and your attention is rapt. And rather than the breath being boring, the breath now becomes so amazingly interesting because the sense of well-being and joy that you have is so much better than almost anything else you can experience. It can be different than other forms of joy. It's different. This non-sensual joy that can come out of meditation is a different kind of joy than sensual joy or conditioned joy, or a joy that arises because the conditions of the world are giving you a cause to be happy. You know, if you win the lottery, some people get happy. But I've been told, I read someplace, that a year after winning the lottery, most people who won the lottery wish they hadn't. You know, their life is not any happier than it was before. It's actually worse. So we think that lottery is a good thing. So there's a lot of happiness that can give us a real kind of rush, even. But the rush of happiness because, you know, we get praised or something is not considered reliable or as clean a kind of happiness and joy as this non-sensual joy that can rise in meditation. It's very clean. So as it arises, rapt attention arises. Different people experience it differently. But sometimes there's a shift and change energetically in the body where the body gets more kind of energized in a kind of like, you know, really clean, strong way. Sometimes the posture changes. The posture sometimes goes more upright and straight. And I remember I sat years of Zen practice where the emphasis was on sitting, you know, in very, very particular meditation posture. You had to sit ideally in full half lotus or full lotus, and you had to kind of sit up straight and have a really good straight back, and you have your hands together like this. And, it, you know, and it's a great way to sit. But, you know, my body just wasn't into it, especially when I was young and, you know, tight and everything. And I used to, you know, like, you know, so I was, and the teachers were always coming, adjusting my posture and helping straighten me out. And then I did this Vipassana practice on retreat. And when this energetic joy, this joyful energy kind of kicked in, it's like this force that kind of kicks in. And my body by itself, and I had a straighter posture than I ever had in Zen. And it wasn't because I was trying to hold it that way with my mind. It wasn't from the outside in that way, but it was from the inside out. This energy, this current was arising within me and holding me upright and present. Some people have reported that it can feel like, for some people, but not everyone. So if you don't like this image, you don't have to have it. But sometimes, like, you know, your body's a rocket and the rocket's taking off. And for some people, it's a lot quieter than that. And can feel very light, very warm. Usually feeling very whole. Sometimes the feelings are very beautiful. Very beautiful feeling, very clean. Some people talk about a process of purification in the process. So, a sense of joy. And so, mindfulness, if you do it diligently, hopefully will lead to a sense of investigation. Investigation hopefully will lead to a little heightened energy and engagement effort. And as you get more fully engaged in the process, hopefully you start getting absorbed in what you're doing. And your interest in other things that are not the meditation fall away. Fall away, fall away. And when that falls away, and you're really there, fully there for what you're paying attention to, like the breath, that then it opens up these channels of joy or delight or well-being that become something that's very helpful for this practice here. It's very important not to be in a hurry. It's very important not to judge yourself or criticize yourself because it's not happening. For two reasons. One, because it's not a good idea. I guess. And the other is that it actually moves you in the opposite direction you're trying to go. You're trying to unify the mind around something. And you start criticizing yourself or criticizing how poorly you're doing and how you're not going far enough, that almost guarantees it's not going to happen. You know, so you're just kind of muddying the water, you're just kind of interfering with the very process as soon as you start doing self-criticism kind of things. Does that make sense? So don't bother. And if you can. And the important thing, in any case, I believe, is not having joy. The important thing is to be mindful and present, and through your mindfulness, understand how you can free yourself from the ways in which your clinging, your resistance, your judgment is causing you suffer. That's the key thing. To be mindful, and with your mindfulness, learn how to be free of suffering, of clinging. That's the key thing. If you keep that in mind, then if you practice and you start thinking, that joy Gil's talking about, I just haven't gotten it yet. Boy, am I a lousy meditator. Wait a minute, he said, more important than joy was to notice where the clinging is, and here is an example. I'm supposed to let go of that. Okay, I let go of that. Okay. That message is a lot better now. Good. Let's try it again. Okay, well, it's easier now that I'm not judging. I wish it was that easy. So, So one of the reasons to talk about the seven factors of awakening and today joy is that some of these potentials, these capacities, can begin showing themselves sometimes very subtly, very slightly at first, and in a very open, generous, light way, without clinging or holding on or building a whole case around it. It's very helpful to learn to recognize their presence and appreciate the presence. If you don't appreciate that joy is there, don't appreciate the value of joy, then you might not actually pay much attention to it. You might not give it enough time in the sun. You might not give it enough attention to feed it. So it's healthy to, when the joy arises, to have very light, unclinging appreciation of it. Oh yeah, this is good. I don't have to push it away. I've known some people who have tried to push away joy in meditation, like it's not good. Some people, because of the religious upbringing they've had in their religion that they grew up in, somehow joy was considered to be a kind of a sin or something wrong about it. You're supposed to always be kind of suffering. This is not even Buddhism. And so I've had the privilege of telling some people who are meditators that it was okay to experience joy, because they had a strong message they weren't supposed to experience it. And then I had the problem once of so in this developmental approach. See, joy is right in the middle of the seven factors of awakening, and there's other factors that go beyond that, above that. And there's much better things in meditation than joy. So at some point I knew that. I had experience of better, more satisfying, deeper, more satisfying experiences than joy. So I started having this meditative joy arise. And I repressed it. I pushed it down. I kept it at bay. I'm like, no, I don't want that stuff. I want the deeper stuff. And I was holding it down. And this force was inside of me, a joy. And I was doing walking meditation at some point for this. And I started feeling this headache. The headache of resisting my joy. Silly, right? But I can be pretty silly. And I noticed it after a while. I said, this is silly. So I let go of my resistance to the joy. And then the joy kind of swelled up. And once I gave it room to be there, then it stayed for about a minute or two, and then I dropped down further. You know, so it's a whole resistant thing. So, you know, as soon as I opened up to it and allowed it to be there, then the practice unfolded and went down to the next level. So don't resist your joy. Appreciate it. But don't always expect it either. Just, you know, mindfulness has, there's a certain, a different kind of joy in mindfulness practice, which is different than this meditative joy that comes with energy and all that. There's the joy, a certain kind of sublime happiness or joy or well-being or satisfaction of knowing that through mindfulness you're in touch with what's true. So even if you are feeling lousy and all the different forms of lousiness, there's a certain satisfaction that can come to knowing, yes, I'm in touch with what's true right now. This is right now, here and now, this is what's true. And there's something very valuable and important in connecting and being present with what's true. And to have the trust and the understanding how valuable it is to connect with what's true can also bring a certain kind of joy. So one way or the other, I hope you leave tonight a little more joyful than you came. So, thank you.